This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's something that caught me off guard in the very first sentence of Say It Loud, Randall Kennedy's latest book. The Harvard Law School professor states, quote, "The writings that follow are the impressions of a black slash Negro slash colored slash African-American law professor born in Columbia, South Carolina in 1954, 4 months after the Supreme Court handed down Brown v. Board of Education," end quote. Black, Negro, colored, African-American. Professor Kennedy, first of all, it's great to have you back on Point. Why did you do that in the very first sentence of your book?
First of all, it's so nice to be on your wonderful show, so thanks for inviting me. Now, to answer your question, I wanted to put that in the very first sentence of the book to signal right off that I'm not into fashion and that I was going to speak very forthrightly and straightforwardly in the language that I prefer to deal with the race question in American life.
And what is that language?
A straightforward language, and a language that doesn't bow to arbiters of taste that really don't know much about our history. So I was quite aware that there would be some people who might take offense, for instance, at me using the word Negro. In fact, I have an essay in the book about the way in which Black Americans have named and renamed themselves over the course of American history. And that essay was prompted by a student who complained about my use of the word Negro. And among the things I said to the student was that I started using the word Negro quite often in 1983, 1984, because of the directive of my boss. Who was my boss? My boss was Mr. Civil Rights, Justice Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah.
He used the word Negro. He used the word Negro. W.E.B. Du Bois used the word Negro. Martin Luther King Jr. used the word Negro. Medgar Evers used the word Negro. Rosa Parks used the word Negro. If those folks could use the word Negro, it's good enough for me.
Wow. Well, look, the whole book, the title of the whole book is Say It Loud on Race, Law, History, and Culture. And it's a compilation of essays that you've written over, the past 20 years. And you have long had a history, Professor Kennedy, of being an independent, deep, heterodox, and very probing thinker about law, history, and the culture. So it's no surprise to me that you would, as you say, luxuriate in the messiness of trying to understand the race line in the United States. But at the same time, I don't know, maybe this says a lot about me or the times we're living in. It was seeing the word colored that really stopped me in my tracks, Randy, because I mean, that is not a word that I would associate that any Black American today might just willingly apply to them to themselves, because that was absolutely a label given to Black Americans.
There's a wonderful organization in America called the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Okay, point
still
taken.
Still exists.
But I mean, well, so why was the NAACP called that then, though?
Well, because there were a lot of wonderful people who were racial reformers, who wanted to fight racism, who wanted to form an organization called the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. But, you know, again, fashion, people don't seem to have any problem with people of color. That's okay. But colored people is, you know, verboten? No, there are many organizations over the course of American history. There are many good people who have referred to themselves as colored people. No, I'm not, you know, that perfectly fine term. All of these terms are fine. What one has to think about is, you know, what's the sentiment, what's the attitude that is behind the use of these terms? If the attitude is a good attitude, if it's a respectful attitude, fine.
Yeah. So, you know, I hear you and applaud you pushing back against any sort of unthinking orthodoxy. It's one of the things I've admired the most about your entire scholarly career. And at the same time, though, I mean, the first essay in Say It Loud is you, it's almost an elegy for your previous optimism about the direction of race relations in this country. So you're still trying to push back against orthodoxies while at the same time, you know, feeling more pessimistic than ever. Explain that messiness to me.
Well, you know, sometimes you're wrong about things and sometimes you change your mind. And in these essays, I say when I think I'm wrong and I fess up. Yeah, I've changed my mind about things. The first essay is an essay about racial optimism and pessimism in American life. And for most of my adult life, I've been a pretty confident optimist. And I have actually chided the pessimists. And when I say optimists, I basically have been a believer in the idea that we shall overcome. And I've been very critical of those who took the position that, no, we shall not overcome. Well, I've been chastened. I'm still an optimist, but I'm a shaken optimist. I'm no longer as confident as I used to be. And, you know, why is that? That's largely because of the last few years, most particularly the ascension of Donald Trump, who trafficked in racism and was very successful in doing so. After all, he made it to the White House. So, you know, I'm certainly willing to change in light of new information.
Mm-hmm. Professor Kennedy, forgive me. I don't actually know this. Is your father still living?
No, my dad is no longer living, but you're right to point out my father. My father was a great man, a great father. I revere him. He was also a thoroughgoing racial pessimist. Mm-hmm. My father believed that, no, we shall not overcome. He believed that... This basically is a white man's country, and it's going to remain such. That was his view, and we argued with him. My younger sister, my older brother, we argued with him, but that was his position. And unfortunately, the great tragedy is he was a smart man, and. You know, it was not an irrational position to take. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the racial pessimists in American history, well, and who are they, by the way? I mean, Alexis de Tocqueville was a pessimist. Thomas Jefferson was a pessimist. Abraham Lincoln was a pessimist. Elijah Muhammad was a pessimist. Malcolm X. I mean, these are, you know, these people, and they had reason to be pessimistic. Now, there is another counter tradition, the optimistic tradition, Frederick Douglass in the 19th century, Martin Luther King, Barack Obama. And it's the optimistic tradition that I've embraced. But like I said, I do feel chastened.
Well, I want to ask you more about your father here, because as I was reading through some of the essays in the book, I kept wondering if you were hearing in your mind as you were writing them, sort of your father saying, "Told you so, Randall," because he was, as you said, you were born in 1954, just a couple of months after Brown v. Board. So the one of the major turning points in civil rights for this country. And your father was a postal worker, your mother an elementary school teacher. Tell me a little bit more about why, though, they moved from South Carolina to Washington, D.C., and therefore also your personal experience regarding race as a young black man in the late 50s.
It's a very brutal story. I asked my father, you know, why did you move? They had just built a house in Columbia, South Carolina, and they moved. I said, why? And my father looked me in the eye and said, the reason we moved is because either I was going to kill a white man or a white man was going to kill me. And both of those would be very bad outcomes. And so I thought the better thing to do was to move the family north. That's why I grew up in Washington, D.C., as opposed to Columbia, South Carolina. They were refugees from the Jim Crow South, and especially my father. My father had seen very brutal, very ugly things, and it was with him all his life. My parents met during World War II, and one of the things that my father talked about and talked about, you know, fairly often, he wore the uniform of the United States along with other black soldiers, yet there were places that a black man wearing the uniform of the United States, willing to sacrifice their lives for the United States, there were places that they could not go into, but German prisoners of war could go into. My father viewed that as a betrayal, and he did not think that the United States had ever taken action that was suitable to address that betrayal.
It's such a harrowing truth. And at the same time, you, by dint of the luck of the year you were born, you were born into a moment where you felt that even given your parents' experience of being black in America, you were a young optimist. Now, Professor Kennedy, we have to take a quick break, but that is what we're going to explore when we come back. I'm talking this hour with Randall Kennedy. He's a professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of many books. His most recent is Say It Loud. It's a compilation of 20 years of Professor Kennedy's writing on race, law, history, and culture. And we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Randall Kennedy. He's a longtime professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of many books. His most recent is Say It Loud. It's a compilation of a number of essays over the past 20 or so years of Professor Kennedy's scholarship and thinking about race, law, history, and culture. And in the previous segment, you heard Professor Kennedy talk about how, by virtue of being born in 1954, his family were, when they moved from South Carolina to Washington, D.C., Professor Kennedy, you used the word refugees from the Jim Crow South. And yet, at the same time as you were growing up, you became, if no longer, but you became an optimist about the direction of race relations in this country. And, I mean, your own career contains within it the very story of the reasons why, I would say, we should and could and perhaps still should be optimistic about race in this country, right? As a young black man, you went to, what was it, Yale for undergrad? And then you were a Rhodes Scholar. Oh, you went to Yale Law School. You clerked for Mr. Civil Rights himself, Thurgood Marshall, when he was a justice on the United States Supreme Court. And so, therefore, this, I'd like you to explain to me why your background gives you a very particular view on what you call black respectability politics. It's one of the best essays, I think, in your book. So how would you, first of all, define what black respectability politics is?
Well, a couple things. First of all, you're absolutely right. In talking about my background, I've been very lucky, very lucky. The best school I've ever attended, by the way, was my high school, St. Albans School for Boys. My parents could not have sent me there. I was a very good tennis player. I had a scholarship to St. Albans. I then went to Princeton. I then went to Oxford. I then went to Yale Law School. I mean, I have been just remarkably privileged, remarkably lucky, and I have to remind myself of that. So, you know, I've been very lucky. I read a lot and I try to pay attention to the scandalous way in which racism continues to wreak havoc in the lives of, you know, all too many Black Americans. But for me, you're right. I've been lucky. As for respectability politics, the civil rights movement was very important in my household. Mm-hmm. So the heroes and heroines of my household were people like Thurgood Marshall, people like Rosa Parks, people like John Lewis, people like James Farmer. And those folks practiced what I refer to as respectability politics. And what I mean by that is they were attentive to the way in which they came off to the public. And they were attentive to the way that they came off to the public because they wanted to bring people over to their side. They knew that they were, you know, they're a minority. They are, in some places, a despised minority. They needed friends. They needed allies. And so they comported themselves accordingly. That's all I mean by respectability politics.
And yet that's a controversial view, right? I mean, amongst a whole spectrum of Black scholars, Black Americans, Black activists. I mean, there's obviously, they're not separate groups of people here. But I mean, you yourself, right? Well, actually, first of all, let me ask you a little bit more about Rosa Parks in particular, because you open your chapter about respectability mm-hmm. politics with her. And you note that she was not the first African-American arrested in Montgomery in the 1950s. But why was it important to you to really point out how she epitomizes respectability, Black respectability politics to you?
I wanted, in that essay, what I was trying to say was, listen, if you're waging a struggle against racism in America, you're going to have to be pragmatic. You can't be sentimental. You have to be careful and pragmatic. So I said, let's take a look at what happened in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955, one of the great moments in American history. E.D. Nixon, who was the main civil rights leader there, he was the person who actually picked Martin Luther King Jr. to be the spokesperson for the movement. He was looking for somebody to be the standard bearer for the Black people of Montgomery. And you're right, there were a couple of people who were arrested for not giving up a seat, but he said, you know, I can't use them for various reasons. They, you know, there's something in their, they've got skeletons in their closet that if they are the standard bearer, the white power structure is going to discredit them in various ways. But then Rosa Parks was arrested. And E.D. Nixon said, hot dog, now we've got our person. And Martin Luther King Jr. said that too in his first speech as a civil rights leader. He said, I'm sorry anybody had to be arrested, but if someone had to be arrested, it's good that it's Rosa Parks, because everybody knows Rosa Parks and everybody knows how upstanding Rosa Parks is. Well, that was respectability politics, and that was a good thing. Now, you know, I'm not going to embrace every instance in which so-called respectability politics has been embraced, because after all, there were some people who said that it was disreputable to be arrested. There were some people who thought that Bayard Rustin, because he was gay, was disreputable. So, you know, we have to be careful in our thinking about respectability politics. Of course, we have to be careful. But the idea of thinking about our words, thinking about our strategies, thinking about the way in which we comport ourselves. That, it seems to me, is just straightforward, simple politics 101. Frankly, yeah, it should not be controversial.
Well, so, you know what? Oh, this is so fascinating to me. Every time I talk with you, Professor Kennedy, I wish we had several hours. But look, it's also legal strategy 101, right? Because for any version of a civil rights movement that seeks to make change, for example, in the courts, it's a strategy as old as the hills to wait for the quote unquote right plaintiff, right?
Like, yes.
So strategy is really the key word here. And as you write about it in your essay on respectability politics, it was essential in terms of the case, if not in the courts, the case that Black Americans were trying to make to the country writ large. But then you also write, and I'm just going to read a passage here from the essay. You write that, quote, most people are and should be attuned to their image. Appearance frequently affects the treatment one receives. Image does not wholly dictate response, but it often makes a difference. This proposition is so obvious as to be banal. Yet some commentators dispute it, asserting that racism is no respecter of respectability. So, with that in mind, Professor Kennedy, I just want to take a few minutes to listen to Brittany Cooper. She's an associate professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and Africana studies at Rutgers University. She's also the co-author of Feminist AF and a very strong critic of respectability politics. And why? Well, Professor Cooper says, look back all the way to the end of Reconstruction in 1877.
So all of a sudden you have newly freed class of Black people and you have angry white Southerners with no accountability or no law in order to keep them from attacking Black people. And in that context, Black leaders and Black community members come together, not in a singular instance, but in terms of their cultural conversations with each other and say, how will we survive this? And they survive it largely by suggesting that what they should do is try to make the case that they are fit for U.S. citizenship by being educated, by being incredibly articulate, by always being upstanding, never committing any crime or social faux pas. And so we come to associate this desire and performance of being respectable and upstanding as being part of African American people's job to argue for our fitness to fit into U.S. body politic and to be, and basically to be able to move around the world unharassed. What happens in the ensuing years is that it moves from being a strategy of survival to becoming a kind of conservative ideology of Black progress, which is to say that it becomes about how Black people just need to behave, pull up your pants, pull down your dress, and if they do so, then things will be fine for them here in America. I think that Barack Obama is probably the shining example of the respectability project among Black people, right? But let us not forget that what happens during the Barack Obama administration is that we end up having a social movement called Black Lives Matter precisely because having a Black president did not keep the police from killing Black folk indiscriminately in the streets, often when they were unarmed and often when they had committed no crimes. And that becomes the fundamental contradiction and the reason why we cannot continue to yell and finger wag at Black communities about how they just need to practice respectability politics. What prior generations did was they did the emotional labor for white people because in many cases that was the only option. So we learned to placate, we learned to conciliate, we learned to make white people feel comfortable with uncomfortable conversations in the hopes that we would win them over to our side. Here is the challenge of that approach now. We are living in the post-Trump era, and so we have seen a resurgence of white supremacy. We are not in a conversation anymore where respectability politics will save us. In fact, we've you know, tested that hypothesis out. We've tried it for over 100 years, and we are right back where we started in a world where we are dealing with white delusion and misinformation and disinformation, all backed up by the continuing threat of violence, not just against Black and brown people, but against white lawmakers who will not toe the line and get on board with a white supremacist project. It feels a bit parochial for sure at this point to say to Black communities that proper decorum will save us from the resurgence of white supremacy.
Brittany Cooper is Associate Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies and Africana Studies at Rutgers University, also co-author of Feminist AF. Professor Kennedy, conservative ideology, conciliatory, finger-wagging, delusional? What do you think?
Well, first of all, I've never said, and the people who are allied with me on this point have never said that, you know, just pulling your pants up, just having good manners is all you need. No, there needs to be a collective, intelligent, militant struggle against racism. But in waging that struggle, don't do things that are going to needlessly alienate people. Now, on the question of the professor said, we're back where we started. Back where we started? As we speak today, the vice president of the United States is a Black American. The head of the Department of Defense is a Black American. There are Black Americans all throughout American life as mayors, as chiefs of police, as head of companies. You know, it would have been miraculous in 1950, but it is familiar in American life today. You know, there have been terrible setbacks. I began our conversation by talking about how chastened I feel because of the ascension of Trumpism. That's right. That was terrible. And there is much work to be done. But the idea that we are right back where we started from in the 19th century, or right back where we started from in 1950, that's way off.
Well,
that's totally unrealistic, and we need to be realistic. We need to be realistic about the problems that we face, but we also need to be realistic about the strong, good forces that we can marshal to make more progress.
So, what Professor Cooper said in the middle of her analysis there, I'd like to focus on that for a second. Because, yes, of course, we're not right back to where we started. We're not back to Jim Crow. Well, at least, I mean, who knows what's going to happen with voting in this country. But she made the point about President Barack Obama, who was, in a sense, the apotheosis of what can be achieved with respectability politics. Brilliant, an expansive thinker, the no drama Obama. He wasn't going to be sucked into the trope of the angry Black man. He was able to create an environment and a politics around him that pulled in a pretty interesting coalition. And at the same time, as you acknowledge in your book, his very presence as a Black man in the White House also engendered one of the ferocious, most ferocious racist backlashes, too. So I think that she's saying, look, in Obama, we have the example of the limits of respectability politics, because it still cannot overcome the fundamentals of white supremacy.
Well, maybe, you know, limits. Everything has a limit. I mean, I don't think that respectability politics is a panacea. I just think it's essential. It's not going to do everything, but I guess what I'm reacting against is a certain sort of, you know, extravagance, a certain sort, frankly, a certain sort of vanity and egotism. I can say what I want. I can act the way I want. And I don't care about these white people. What? If you're part of a political movement, you can't say that. Now, if you want to just, you know, go off on your own and simply express how you feel, well, okay, fine. But the people that I'm talking about are people who I had thought wanted to be part of a political movement to actually change things in American life.
Well, Professor Kennedy, hang on for just a minute, because we still have a lot more to talk about. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are having a remarkable conversation with Professor Randall Kennedy. He's a professor at Harvard Law School, author of many books, and his latest is a compilation of some 20 years of his thinking about race, law, history, and culture. It's called Say It Loud. And Professor Kennedy, if you could, I'd love you to read a little bit from the book, because you very honestly and with candor weave in your own life experience into everything that you talk about in the book. And since we were speaking about respectability politics, could you read the first half of a paragraph there in your essay on that from page 128?
Sure. Black respectability politics has continued to be widely championed. A form of it was certainly propounded by my parents, who inculcated in their three children a sense of racial kinship, such that in our dealings with the white world, we were encouraged to think of ourselves as ambassadors of blackness. My parents told us that our achievements would advance the race and that our failures would lower it. They insisted that the fulfillment of our racial obligations required that we speak well, dress suitably, and mind our manners. In our household, we felt tremendous pride in the attainment of blacks. We also took personally their disgrace.
An excerpt from Randall Kennedy's book, Say It Loud. So with that in mind, again, your own life story as a black man in America, tell me a little bit more then on what you saw following the murder of George Floyd and the surge of across the nation activism that came with the Black Lives Matter movement.
Well, I saw a quite wonderful response. I think that the activists who had, prior to that tragic killing, the activists who for several years had been trying to focus attention on the problem of police brutality and racism in police misconduct. They had been working that field. They had been trying to educate people, and then this happened, and they saw the fulfillment of some of their work. They got hundreds of thousands of people out in the street. They succeeded in putting the problem of policing front and center in our public consciousness. And that was a good thing. And in my essay, I applaud them for it. Now, do I have, you know, some you know, misgivings? Do I have some cautions? Sure, I do. So, for instance, there were some parts of the protest movement that pushed the idea of, abolish the police. And, you know, I said, no, that's not a good idea, abolish the police. I mean, in a large modern society like ours, you need to have some agency that has the authority to compel order and to protect people from criminality. So we should hold on with this abolish the police idea. That's not well taken. But there was much to applaud with the activism of the George Floyd moment.
So the title of that essay is The George Floyd Movement: Promise and Peril.
Yes.
Now, is the peril what you write about there, about what happens next with any protest movement? You talk about the dulling power of inertia when everyone goes home, essentially, and bureaucracies return to the status quo ante.
That's one part of the peril. Yeah. I mean, one part of the peril is that this will simply be a moment that will then go back to, standard operating procedure. That's a peril. And the reason why that's a peril is because standard operating procedure is so dangerous and so threatening and so bad. And so to sort of go back would be quite terrible. That's one problem. And another problem is, simply coming up with ideas that are just mistaken ideas. And that's a peril.
Mistaken ideas such as?
Well, I just mentioned one. I mean, the whole, the abolition of police, abolition of prisons. Again, the tendency to, I'll go back to fashion. I thought that the Black Lives Matter movement, on the whole, I applauded. There were some instances, however, in which you had people who were obviously sympathetic to Black Lives Matter. They were obviously sympathetic. And then they would be talking, and then they would say something like, "Yeah, I'm totally down with Black Lives Matter, because of course all lives matter." And then they would be booed. Then they, things would be thrown at them. It was as if you simply said all lives matter, that was, that was verboten. And it seemed to me mistake. Listen, what these people are saying is, of course, all lives matter, including Black lives. And to the extent that Black lives have been minimized, that's a bad thing. Black lives matter, punctuation mark. Again, people should, not grasp on to marginal rhetorical, quote, mistakes and be put in the doghouse. What we need to do is listen carefully to people and actually have a rather generous attitude toward folks. If folks are trying to inch toward racial decency, let them, for goodness sakes.
So you're still an optimist then?
Well, yeah, I'm a chastened optimist. I'm still in the optimistic camp ultimately.
Because you still think it's possible for people to inch towards racial decency. That's what you just said.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, we saw that in the aftermath of the George Floyd killing. We saw people all over the country. And by the way, we of course need to be mindful of our history of racism. We, of course, need to be mindful of the way in which racism continues to be a looming, dangerous presence in American life. At the same time, we need to be mindful of our history of anti-racism. And we need to be mindful of the way in which, at this very moment, there are millions of Americans who want to repudiate our racist history and our racist present and push the country upwards. Let's not forget those people.
So wait, tell me more about what you mean about your cautions about anti-racism.
Well, I mean, let's not forget the anti-racist tradition in American life. I mean, you know, when we talk about American history, for example, let's not forget Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner. Let's not forget the people. There have been people of all complexions who have struggled against racism in American life. Let's not forget them. That's all.
Okay. There's so much to discuss with you, Professor Kennedy. Before we wrap up here, another sort of, you talked about the concern over the language around abolishing the police, but the language about abolishing institutions that some activists feel are inherently racist is very powerful. Another place you hear that is around around activists who believe in prison abolishment. So Listen with me for a moment to Jen Jackson, assistant professor of political science at Syracuse. And the focus of Professor Jackson's advocacy has been around prison reform and particularly what it means for Black Americans. And Jackson, in fact, pushes for the abolition of prisons.
Prison abolition is about removing prisons and getting rid of the buildings, actually tearing down the buildings, getting rid of the facades and the structures that remind us that we have bought into systems that tell us that people who do things that we deem as crimes or people who we identify as deviant, and I put all this in air quotes because even the ways that crime is deemed important or critical in certain communities is also rooted in our own historical biases in the long arc of slavery. We know that for Black folk, imprisonment carries heavier sentences, greater weights in terms of the financial burdens, less likelihood of getting out, greater likelihood of recidivism, harder times when folks come out of prison, being able to find jobs, places to live, food to eat, right? So it's not just about the buildings themselves, but also about the symbolic nature of incarcerating people and what we all kind of silently are complicit in. As an abolitionist, I frequently get the question, what about rapists? What about murderers? What about sociopaths, right? Like, what about all these bad people? We know that any form of crime typically happens within community. And the underlying notion of restorative justice is that you identify the sites of harm, the people who have been harmed, the communities that have been harmed, and you center their needs and concerns. So they dictate what the outcomes are. And then how do we look directly in the face of the people who are responsible and hold them accountable, right? That could be financial accountability. It could be service acts. It could be public apologies. It could be, you know, it could be a number of things. You know, a lot of abolitionists, we get a lot of flack and we get a lot of criticism because it's like, oh, you're so frou-frou. You're a tree hugger. Oh, you want everyone to be happy and get along and hold hands and sing kumbaya. But I think that really what we're asking for is empathy. The fact that these are folks who, as they say sometimes about young white boys, made mistakes sometimes, right? Who are imperfect. We are all imperfect. And I think that what we really lack in this conversation, we lack empathy for the notion that humans are imperfect and we don't get it right. And that includes the humans who decided on the building full of boxes for punishment.
Jen Jackson, assistant professor of political science at Syracuse University. Professor Kennedy, we've only got 3 minutes left here, so I would love to give you a minute here to respond to Professor Jackson, and then I've got another question to help us sort of wrap up this conversation. But your take on the prison abolition movement.
couple quick points. First, the situation with imprisonment in the United States is scandalous. There are far too many people in prison. Our country is hyper punitive. We punish people too severely. I agree with all of that. And so to that extent, I think that I'm aboard with what your other commentator was saying. Now, there are serial rapists. There are serial murderers. There are people who, if they are not incapacitated, would wreak havoc on us. They need to be incapacitated. We need to have some way of protecting our communities from people who do terrible things. And who is it, by the way, who especially needs protection? Poor people, poor communities. Those are the communities that are most vulnerable to criminality. You know, wealthy people can go in gated communities. They can get their own security forces. It's regular folks who need the police and who need prisons for protection. Yeah. So that's what I have to say.
It makes me so sad that we only have a minute and a half left, Professor Kennedy. But my last question for you is, I keep thinking about your father, right? Because he had zero optimism, right, for the United States as a Black man who was born in 1917. But as I hear you over the course of this hour, I'm going to take back what I said earlier. I don't think that your latest book is an elegy for your optimism about race in America. But perhaps instead of if I can put it this way, it's a bit of a graying, a looking to what baton is it that you and your generation are handing over to the next generation of Americans. So in the last 30 seconds we have here, you maybe don't see racial egalitarianism in your lifetime, but at least racial decency. Give me a couple sentences on what that looks like to you.
Well, I do feel sad. I feel sad because I have three children. They're in their 20s. And the America that is being handed to them is a much more troubled America than I had anticipated. And, that profoundly saddens me.
Well, Randall Kennedy's new book is Say It Loud, on Race, Law, History, and Culture. And there's so much more in it, so do pick it up. Professor Kennedy, always an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.